In sports, the story of an underdog who triumphs in the face of all odds can perhaps only be bested by the story of an underdog team that triumphs in the face of all odds. This is the story of the boys in the boat. 9 of them, to be exact, in an extraordinarily long boat that, given all the same specs as a bunch of other boats, paddled the fastest at the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, where the U.S. men's rowing team won the gold right under Hitler's nose. The event was captured in great detail by Nazi propagandists. You can watch it on YouTube with a pretty quick search. But the deeper story of the winners in Berlin that day takes us back to Depression-era Pacific Northwest. The author of the book is our guest today. He's written 3 books in all, Under a Flaming Sky and The Indifferent Stars Above. His latest, The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics, is now a New York Times #1 bestseller. A version of the book edited for younger readers came out this month in paperback and also in audio form. We welcome Daniel J. Brown, the author, to the exchange today. Daniel Brown, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So there's so much going on in this story, a really pretty timeless one, but first, I need to know a little bit more about the sport of rowing, which is so central to this book and draws all these different elements and time periods and characters together. Were you already into rowing before you wrote The Boys in the Boat?
No, I knew nothing about rowing, and I hadn't rowed myself at all. And so it was a steep learning curve for me to, I wanted to get the technical aspects of the sport right, of course, but I also, even more than that, I wanted to get the experience of rowing down. So I spent a lot of time early in the research for this book talking to rowers. The folks at the University of Washington Shell House gave me access to their coaches and their best rowers, and then through them I met Olympic-caliber rowers. And it took a while, but I really wanted to know you know, what it feels like to row in a really high-stakes race. What does it feel like to row on a river as opposed to a lake? What does it feel like to row in rough weather? Those kinds of experiential things. And so it took a while, but I gradually got pretty familiar with it.
So the Shell House, you mentioned that you started your research or did your research at the University of Washington Shell House. That's where they keep these boats, and are they called shells?
Yes, they're called shells, and these days the competitive shells are all made of modern synthetic materials. In the days I'm writing about, they were these beautiful handcrafted Western red cedar shells, and to this day they keep the Husky Quipper, the boat that these boys won Olympic gold in. They have it on display in the Shell House, hanging from the ceiling with lights trained on it. And it's an absolutely gorgeous thing to behold.
Now, the boys you write of, the boys in the boat, and the boat you just mentioned is the Husky Clipper, their story culminates at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. The 1932 Olympics were in Los Angeles. How had the world changed in those 4 years for the main characters in your story?
Well, you know, the Depression had gradually sunk in and begun to take a terrible toll. All 9 of these guys were working class kids from the Pacific Northwest. These were kids that grew up in mill towns and on dairy farms and so forth in Western Washington. And so as the Depression took hold, they were all struggling to stay in school. They were all struggling to get a couple meals a day. And so since 1932, things were hard in 32, but they were even harder by 1936. And that sort of essential struggles for survival is sort of the backdrop to the story of what happened with this crew.
And your central character, Joe Rance, he's kind of the heartbeat of this story. And for much of it, he's a very young man. But you describe meeting him on his deathbed. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's how this story started. It literally walked into my life one day. My neighbor Judy came to me, and she was reading one of my earlier books to her dad, who was living under hospice care at her home. And he was enjoying that book and asked if he could meet me. So I think it was the next day I went down. And I met Joe Rance, this elderly gentleman stretched out on a recliner, and he was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. So I sat down next to him, and we just talked very briefly about that earlier book, And then he began to talk about his experience as a kid growing up during the Depression, and he had this really terrible family situation to overcome. He was basically abandoned by his father and his stepmother and left to forage in the woods for food, and that story in itself really got to me. But then he went on and he began to talk about how he had begun to row at the University of Washington and starting in the fall of 1933, and how that had begun to sort of transform and redeem his life, and how he and his crewmates had become closer and closer, and how they had wound up rowing for this Olympic gold medal against a German boat in front of Hitler in Berlin in 1936. And, I mean, my jaw just dropped as I heard this story. It was just so utterly compelling. So the whole book really came out of that initial conversation.
And you bring us back to this 1936 Olympic Games, which I'm curious, in talking to Joe Rance, one of the boys on the boat, he told you his story. I'm assuming maybe not many of them were still living and able to be interviewed, but Joe was drawing on 80 years of memories. When and where did his recollections come into the sharpest focus?
You know, I was very blessed by the fact that Joe only lived about 2.5 months after I first met him. And he was very clear mentally, and he had very specific recollections, and particularly about the experience of being abandoned, and particularly about the experience of going to Berlin that summer. But he did die a couple months after I met him. And what was fortunate was that his daughter Judy had spent the last 5 years or so of her dad's life literally following him around with a pad of paper and a pencil, asking him just incredibly detailed questions about, you know, what kind of food was in the house that night your family left you, and what was the weather like. And so even after Joe was gone, I had really detailed information about his life to work with.
How amazing that he was able to recall those kinds of details. I hardly remember what I had for breakfast. We're talking right now with Daniel J. Brown, the author of The Boys in the Boat. It's a New York Times bestseller and quite a compelling story. A version geared towards young readers came out in paperback this month, as well as an audio book. We'll be back with Daniel J. Brown and more of the story of The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics, on the flip side of a very short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. On the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking about a scrappy rowing team who took it all in a very upper crust sport, winning Olympic gold on German soil back in 1936. The author of The Boys in the Boat, Daniel J. Brown, joins us, and so can you. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Daniel Brown, we've been talking about the main character, well, really one of nine in this book, The Boys of the Boat. How did you go about creating realistic portraits of the entire University of Washington crew team circa 1936?
Well, I had a lot of help from the families of each of these nine guys. When the families found out what I was doing, they were very excited. They have all been sitting on this story for, at that time, 75 years. Hoping that somebody would come along to tell it. So through Joe's daughter, Judy, I met the one or more people from each of the families, and they began to come to me with boxes of letters and diaries and news clippings and old photographs. And more importantly, they sat down with me for many, many hours talking about their father or their grandfather, as the case might be. And it was really through them that I was able to put together, a portrait of the unique personality of each of these nine guys, which was a big relief to me. You know, when I started the project, I had only met Joe, and I didn't really know anything about the other guys. For all I knew, it could have been Joe and eight jerks in a boat. But fortunately, they all turned out to be really, really interesting guys and really wonderful, both young men and it turned out later in life, wonderful older men as well.
Did you get to meet any of them in person besides Joe Rantz?
The only other guy that was alive was Roger Morris, the bowman. So he lived for about a year after I started the project, and so I did get to spend some time with him.
With Roger. And so these families really connected with you and were supporting what you're doing. Have the stories of these nine rowers, had they been told or brought together like this before in any other form?
No, not really. You know, rowing was covered very extensively in the newspapers in the 1930s. It was a major sport in the 1930s. So a lot of ink was spent on crew, and both in the national press and in the local press in Seattle. Quite a bit was written about them then. But the story really sort of faded into obscurity after the Olympics. And there were people when I started this, people of a certain age in Seattle who remembered the story. But by and large, people had forgotten about it.
And the boys that you ended up learning so much about, you said they were working class boys. Can you talk more about that? I think it's interesting. I think of rowing, no offense to any rowers out there, but it does strike you as sort of an upper crusty sport. What kinds of jobs did the 1936 University of Washington crew team have in when they weren't rowing?
Yeah, so well, when they were in school, they were janitors mostly. Actually, that was a popular job on campus. As long as they stayed on crew, the university promised them at least a part-time job, which was why it's so important to all of them to stay on the crew during the Depression. So they had, you know, they had the kinds of jobs that young people would have on a university campus. But in the summers, they worked in shipyards. Some of them worked on building the Grand Coulee Dam in the summer of 1935. They worked in logging towns. Joe worked out in the farms out in Squim, Washington. So they did hard manual labor. These were very much blue-collar kids, Northwest kids. And, yeah, part of the charm of the story is that to get to their dream, they had to go up against and defeat, first, their very good rivals at Cal Berkeley, but then beyond that, they had to take on these kids from the Ivy League schools in the East, kids who had learned to row in prep school in many cases, and vanquish them. And then they had to go on and defeat kids from Oxford and Cambridge in the UK, kids who were literally aristocrats in some cases. And then finally they had to take on this hand-picked Nazi crew in Berlin. And so that's the sense in which it really is a classic American underdog story. They were always taking on higher and higher levels of prestige and power.
That trajectory from, you know, beating California to the Ivy League to literal aristocrats. Had a West Coast rowing team ever bested these East Coast and then English rivals?
You know, by the mid-1930s, the two West Coast rowing powerhouses were Washington and California. And by the mid-1930s, they had begun to sporadically win races on the East Coast. And so it wasn't entirely unprecedented, but there was still the general belief, certainly, particularly in the East, that rowing that rowing was an elite sport, that rowing was an Eastern sport, and that these upstart, rough and tumble young men from the West Coast were sort of an aberration. So when Washington went all the way and to the Olympics and won the gold in such a spectacular fashion in 1936, it really sort of ended that way of thinking about the sport.
Do you, in interviewing the families, were the boys aware of the class element, crucially aware of the class element, while they were living it?
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure they were. The press was full of it. The press made a great deal about the regional conflict, East versus West, and also the class distinctions. The guys themselves, I think they were to some extent oblivious of that. I know that when they got to Princeton for the Olympic trials, they thought the kids at Princeton were kind of snooty. But they were just about doing the best they could at what they were doing, And I don't think they thought a great deal about that part of it.
Did Joe ever talk to you about how he felt about being teased as Hobo Joe?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when Joe showed up, you know, at the university in 1933, it was the Depression. A lot of people were really struggling, obviously, but Joe was particularly poor, and he had to show up every day at crew practice wearing the same moth-eaten old sweater, and the kids tended to pick on him about that, about his clothes, because he just didn't have any way to have anything nicer than what he had been wearing for years. And he did talk about that, and he was quite emotional about that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, on this whole team, I think you, Joe, described over almost 200 boys trying out for 9 spots in a boat. He ends up on the team, and of a kind of blue-collar make to everyone there, he perhaps is in the most dire circumstances. Can you talk about his abandonment by his family? And then he did have someone there. He had Joyce. Do we get to meet her in the book, and what role did she play?
Yeah, so he was, as I say, his family just up and drove away and left him right in the beginning of the Depression, and he was left to fend for himself out in Squim, Washington, in a half-built house. He wound up having to forage in the woods for mushrooms and berries and poach salmon out of the Dungeness River and things like that just to survive. And those were dark years for Joe. He was just a kid. And the only person in his life who was there constantly for him was this girl he met on the school bus, literally sitting at the back of the school bus playing his guitar, which was one of his things he liked to do. He met this girl named Joyce, and they worked together for the rest of their lives. They married after they graduated from the university. She went to the University of Washington at the same time he did, which was a little bit unusual, a little bit precocious for a woman in the 1930s, for a farm girl like Joyce, and that's really what she was. To go to the university was kind of a big deal, and she did very, very well there. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa, in fact. So she was the one person who really understood Joe and saw him through those very hard times.
We're talking with Daniel J. Brown about his book, The Boys in the Boat. I'm Emily Curitan, hosting for Jeffrey Riley today. This conversation also includes you. You can give us a call, 800-838-3760, to talk about a pretty fascinating story of the Olympic gold medal winners at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. We've got a caller on the line. Bill in Arcata has been waiting patiently. Bill, thank you so much for calling. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Emily. I just wanted to mention, among a lot of stories, how rowing intersects with politics. In 1963, on the dock at the Penn Rowing Club, I met Prince Rainier and Grace Kelly of Monaco, and I raced in George Pocock wooden shells. And we had a lot of stories, but that's the one that is closest to yours.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, those Pocock shells, there's fewer and fewer of them still around, and they're such beautiful things. And of course, because they're made of wood, they're no longer competitive for racing. But one of the very nice things about the coming out of the book is that I understand people are finding old Pocock shells and restoring them because of their interest in the story. And so
George Pocock, let's step back there. He was the boat maker of the winning boat for this team. What was his story? How did he get involved and become such an icon of the sport?
Oh, Pocock was a fascinating fellow. He grew up in England, apprenticed to his father as a boat builder at Eton College in London, building racing shells for the very, very upper crust kids that went to Eton. And then he emigrated first to Canada and then down to Seattle, and he began to build these beautiful handcrafted cedar rowing shells. And they were just spectacularly beautiful, and they were also state-of-the-art. By the mid-1930s, every rowing program in the country had a Pocock shell and wanted more Pocock shells. They were so much in demand. But the thing about Pocock, he was a master craftsman at building boats, but he was also a very, very good rower. and he mentored many of these boys, and he taught them to approach rowing the way he approached his craft of building boats, to approach rowing as a craft and to put their hearts into it and to take great pride in it. And that had an enormous influence, particularly on Joe Rantz, but really on all nine of these guys, and to tell you the truth, on generations of rowers at Washington. It was hugely influential.
You said the wooden boats, the kind that he designed and pioneered the design of, they're not competitive anymore because they're using fiberglass boats?
Fiberglass and carbon fiber, which are, of course, much, much lighter materials. And so you can't be competitive in a wooden boat. It's simply too heavy. But they are, as I say, people are preserving them, and it's fun to row in them. People are still rowing in them just for fun.
And so George Pocock, the maker of the boat that paddled to victory in the 1936 Olympics, the coach for that boat, I'd like to talk about him as well and where he came from. I'm assuming it wasn't Eaton, Al Ubrickson.
Right. Al Ubrickson was he was the head coach at University of Washington during these years. Ubrickson was a fascinating guy. He was very reticent. He didn't say much at all, and he was very steely-faced and not terribly communicative. But he was absolutely obsessed with the idea of going to the Olympics and winning gold. Cal Berkeley had done that twice before, and Ubrickson really wanted Washington to go in 1936. And the thing about Ubrickson was that, although he wasn't a great communicator, he was really very, very good at the sort of alchemy of putting a great crew together, mixing and matching different physical types and different personality types in the boat to try to get the combination that would go as fast as possible. And that's really what happened in 1936, is during the spring of that year, leading up to the Olympics, he fiddled around with different boating assignments until he got a boat that just couldn't be beat.
And did all of the boys in this boat come from the University of Washington?
Yes, so they were all University of Washington students. It works differently now. Olympic rowing teams, Olympic teams are put together in an entirely different way by selecting the best rowers from around the country and then putting them in a boat. The disadvantage of that is that they typically don't have a great deal of experience rowing together, just a month or two maybe of rowing together, and so they aren't necessarily able to forge the really strong team bonds that a university team would have.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched, and anyone can do this, the video of the event, the culminating event in this book, The Boys in the Boat, is on YouTube. A German filmmaker made it as part of the Nazi propaganda machine, and you can, you know, hear the barks of the rowers and actually see the American team pull ahead of the Germans and upset this games. I'd like to talk more about that moment. And you just mentioned something I hadn't even thought of, that the Olympic, this team, they weren't trying out for the Olympics the way we think of athletes trying out today. They all began in the same place and they all ended in the same place. There's something very, very poignant about that. Did it make you nostalgic for a different era of college and international athletics?
Yeah, it kind of does. There was a kind of innocence to it and a purity to it that is hard to see in both collegiate and professional athletics these days. There was absolutely no money involved in it, and these kids were simply bound together by this experience that it spanned 3 years that they came together as this crew. And so a lot of it was about the heart of these young men and how they grew close to one another and began to trust one another. And as I say, they were all amateurs. They were just walk-ins. They were farm kids. They weren't recruited from, you know, Romania or someplace the way that rowers are these days by major programs. So there was a kind of purity to it and an amateurness to it that was very, very appealing.
And so we can get a very searing picture here. What were the specs of the race? How long, distance-wise, were they rowing, and how long did it take them to do it, and what was the length of the boat, that kind of thing?
Right. So the gold medal, the Olympic races, were 2,000-meter races, which are relatively short. To win the national championship just a couple months before, they had to row a 4-mile race on the Hudson River in Poughkeepsie. But then they had to turn around and row basically were sprints, 2,000-meter races for the Olympic events. So those races in those days took about 6 minutes to row as fast as they could. And the boats were about 24 feet long, about 24 inches wide. And yeah, those are the basic specs. It was a very fast-paced event, the Olympic rowing.
And at that point in time, the Germans were the favorite on the international scene?
Yes. You know, going into this, into the summer of 1936, actually the British were probably the favorite. These kids from Oxford and Cambridge and the Leander Club in Great Britain, which is really, in many ways, where the sport was born, were the favorites. And to get to the gold medal round, these American kids had to defeat the Brits in a qualifying race, which they just barely did. In fact, they set a world and Olympic record beating the British in that qualifying race.
And as we'll get into after this short break, the national sports competitions were soon to break out into World War II, or I guess dissolve into World War II. I want to tackle that historical context and really go to those Olympics in 1936 Berlin with our guest today, Daniel J. Brown, author of The Boys in the Boat. I'm Emily Curitan, hosting for Jeffrey Riley. We've got quite a bit more to talk about after a short break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange with me, your host, Emily Curitan, in for Jeffrey Riley. We're talking with Daniel J. Brown about his book, The Boys in the Boat. We're also talking with you. You're welcome to join this discussion. Phone number is 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. So this book, The Boys in the Boat, and our conversation today takes us back to the 1936 Olympics and the U.S. rowing team that took the gold medal there aboard the Husky Clipper. Daniel Brown, the atmosphere at those games just must have been so intense. I mean, the Nazis were really busy choreographing racial superiority and doing some other awful things. Meanwhile, Jesse Owens wins 4 gold medals. Can you take us to Berlin, 1936? I mean, for example, where did the athletes stay?
Yeah, so most of the athletes at the Olympics stayed in the Olympic Village in Berlin, but the rowing events were at a place called Grunau, which is south east of Berlin, maybe 12, 15 miles, on a beautiful piece of water called the Langer See. And so the kids from Washington, the U.S. Olympic rowing team, stayed in a little village there called Köpenick, in an old police barracks, actually. And, yeah, the atmosphere was fascinating because the Nazi Party had recently come to power and was flexing its muscles, and everybody was falling into conformity with that. The boys were very amused that whenever they walked up to a German citizen, the German would extend his right hand and say, Heil Hitler. And so the boys took to extending their right hand and saying, Heil Roosevelt, in return. It just amused them to do that.
Were they, in your conversations with Joe Rance, one of the boys in the boat, and the families of many of the other of the 9 men who won gold at this Olympics, were they aware of this kind of politics of racial supremacy, and did they see it in their own sport or in their own country too?
You know, they weren't aware of it, and that's really sort of the point. The Nazis were very, very successful in staging the 1936 Olympics as a propaganda device. To obscure that, I mean, well, they basically sanitized Berlin before all these thousands of foreigners began to show up for the games. They removed these very racist newspapers from street stands. They literally scrubbed the streets clean. They rounded up homeless people and Roma people and sent them away to camps from which they never returned. And they turned Berlin into almost a make-believe, almost a movie set that portrayed Germany as a very clean, modern, enlightened, progressive state. And the fact is they were very successful. The thousands and thousands of Americans who went to Berlin that summer mostly came back favorably impressed by what they saw in Germany. And that was really the point of what the Nazis were doing.
And was this men's team, this U.S. Team from the University of Washington, was it an all-white team as well? I mean, was there any, I guess, diversity at that time?
There really wasn't much diversity. They were all white. Bobby Mock, the coxswain, it was kind of interesting, learned just before he went to Nazi Germany that he was Jewish. His father had actually concealed that fact from him because there was so much anti-Semitism here in the United States in the 1930s that his father had decided simply to not make that public, and he hadn't even told his own children. So Bob learned just before he went to Germany that his heritage was Jewish, but that was really the only kind of diversity in that book.
And did he have any idea what was going on at that time?
No. I mean, as I say, they didn't yet really know. Uh-huh. They knew that Hitler was a thug. They knew he was a dictator, but nobody could yet see what was about to happen. They were, in fact, building Dachau the summer that these games took place, but that was far outside of Berlin, and nobody could see what was going on there.
So when you talk to the families about this, how did you piece together the climax of your story, this this big win at this race?
Well, you know, so I talked to all the families, and very importantly, several of the guys kept journals that summer when they were in Berlin. So I used those diaries a great deal because they gave day-to-day accounts of leading up to the race and what they were doing and what they were thinking, what their impressions of Germany were, and so on. And then also the event was covered very, very extensively in the press, in the newspapers. Rowing was a big deal in those days, and a lot of ink was spilled in the newspapers. So I had a lot of source material to work with in terms of actually getting to that gold medal race and the situation that they faced that day.
We've been talking about why it was a big deal for this University of Washington team to go on, beat their rivals, beat the Ivy Leaguers, beat the prep school boys, and eventually take Olympic gold. A lot of it has to do with the fact that nobody expected them to. Once they did, how did that change? Did that change the tenor of the games themselves outside the lives of these individuals?
Yeah, I don't know if it changed the tenor of the games. It certainly made an impression. The Nazis who were there that day, Hitler and Goebbels and Goering, were all there that day watching these races. Germany won gold medal in the first five rowing events leading up to the 8-ord race, which is the big prestige event of the day. When the Americans won that race, they just disappeared from the scene. Clearly, we're not happy at all with that outcome. I don't think it greatly changed the tenor of the game, though, of the sport.
Do we get to find out what happens to the boys when they become men, outside of the frame of the story?
Yeah, so, you know, they came back from Berlin that summer with gold medals, and it was interesting. These were an unusually humble bunch of guys. Almost all of them took those gold medals and stuffed them in sock drawers and closed drawers and hardly ever mentioned the gold medals. Some of their kids didn't even know about them until they were adults.
I love the story of the squirrel running off with the gold medal at Joe Rance's house.
Yeah, Joe's medal disappeared for years and years, and nobody in the family could find it. And they were remodeling, putting a new roof on the house, and they found the gold medal up in the attic in some nesting material. Either a squirrel or a rat had had found it, taken a liking to it, and taken it up there and hidden it away. So,
did any of the boys go on to become soldiers?
You know, actually, none of them saw combat as far as I could tell. Some of them served in the Merchant Marine. Most of them, what seems to have happened is five of them were engineering students at University of Washington, and they all wound up working at Boeing on war airplanes. Airplanes for the war effort. And I think what happened is they were diverted into engineering jobs there. I think they were more valuable as engineers at Boeing than they were as troops in the infantry.
Right. A couple of them actually met in an engineering class, right?
Yeah, actually, Joe and Roger, who were particularly close, met right at the beginning in 1933 as freshmen in an engineering class.
So how old would these, were they all the same age?
No, I think Shorty Hunt was the youngest. He was 17 at the beginning of that year. I think he turned 18 that summer. And then it ranged from that up to 20 or 21, I think.
We're talking now with Daniel J. Brown, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Boys in the Boat. Last chance for your questions and comments on this edition of the Jefferson Exchange. You can reach us at 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Daniel, today we've been revisiting events that took place before a lot of us were born. And the book, the version of it that is actually on my desk here, is one that's been retooled for younger readers. Can you talk to us about how the book or the story changed in this version?
Yeah, so we did this because I've been getting emails for 2 years from parents and grandparents and teachers saying basically, wow, this story has so many, such an interesting exposure to history, but also so many great life lessons. I really wish there was a version that my 10-year-old or my 11-year-old or 12-year-old could read for himself or herself. So we set out to produce one of those, and basically what we did, we shortened it a good deal. We took out some of the more esoteric material about rowing strokes and some of the more detailed information about the socioeconomic conditions in Nazi Germany and things like that, although we left enough of the history in so kids would be exposed to the Dust Bowl and the Depression and the Nazis and so on. We took stuff out. We shortened chapters. There's many, many more chapters, each one much shorter. We simplified some of the language just to make it a little more accessible, and we added a lot of graphic elements. We added photographs, and we added more photographs, and we added a timeline to help kids keep track of the several different strands in the story, a photo gallery of all the main characters in the book so they could keep track of who's who, a diagram of a racing shell so they could understand the parts of the boat, and so various visual elements like that. But what the most important thing was, we really strove to keep the heart of the story there, particularly the Joe Rant story, but the larger story about how these young men built these bonds of trust and how that enabled them to become the Olympic champions that they became. That's all still in there.
There's some amazing pictures in this young adult version, which I am assuming were provided to you by the family of the rowers. Are those in the bestseller paperback version as well?
Yes. There are photos in the bestseller paperback edition. We did add a few nude photographs to the young readers edition. Those are mostly photographs of Joe and Joyce when they were young. We just wanted kids to be able to, understand that when this happened, these were young people like themselves.
And so a lot of these changes were intended to make the book geared towards younger readers. Did you succeed? Are you getting feedback from young people? And what are they telling you about the story?
Yeah, well, the book's only been out in this format for a couple of days, so I haven't gotten a lot of feedback. But I was getting feedback from kids just a little older who were reading the adult edition of the book. And that's part of the reason I wanted to do this edition, was that I get kids come up to me at book events who are just clutching the book and just absolutely enthralled at how motivational they have found it. Whether they're trying to be get on the basketball team or trying to be first violin in the school orchestra or whatever their goal is, it's been really cool. A lot of kids have just been really motivated and inspired by this story.
And the story, it gives voice to a generation that um, is is kind of passing before our eyes. Was that your intention when you started?
Yeah, very much so. You know, the day I met Joe Rantz, one of the first things that I thought of when I met Joe was my own father. My father, his father died in 1929, right at the beginning of the Depression, and so his family struggled a great deal. My dad didn't row, but my dad was very much of that generation. And when I heard Joe's story, so much of it sounded like my father's story, my uncles, my aunts, all the people I grew up with from that generation. I really wanted this book to be a tribute, you know, to these nine guys, but really to these nine guys as representatives of that generation, because I am just a huge fan of what they did, how they learned to pull together as a generation and get great things done.
Do you think the economic and the social context that people are living in today echoes that time period?
I do, to an extent. I mean, you know, we've not been through the Great Depression here, but we have been through the Great Recession, and so I think some of that resonates, the economic hard times. But more than that, I think it's the uncertainty. We forget how terrifying it was to live during the Depression. Nobody knew if it was going to get worse. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. The world seemed really fragile and uncertain. And I kind of think that that's the way it feels to a lot of people these days, as if things are just very tentative and uncertain. And so, yes, I think there's a resonance there.
And for you, did the story resonate enough for you to take up rowing?
I've hardly rowed at all. I've been so busy with the book. I have offers to learn to row from coaches from Maine to San Diego. And when all this hoopla is done, I think I may give it a try. I think I might try to learn to scull, which is to row in a single boat. I think that might be what I attempt.
Well, you mentioned the hoopla. The book has been a wild success. Should we expect a movie version anytime soon?
Well, I hope so. I think so. We sold the movie rights several years ago to the Weinstein Company. That's the company that made The King's Speech and a number of other Oscar films. And I'm not entirely in the loop on that, but last I heard, they are working on a script, and I think they're getting close to a script that they like. So we shall see what comes out of that, but it sounds like they're moving forward.
Well, we've been talking today with Daniel J. Brown, the author of The Boys in the Boat. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics. Daniel J. Brown, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks for having me.